All right, so I have a little historical context that we can go over, but I was going to do that after question one. So let's just go ahead and jump in and see what y'all think about number one. So describe Cornelius and his personality traits that are revealed in this text.
He's a man.
This is true.
He's magnanimous and dutiful.
Whoa there. Hold on, let me get my dictionary out.
And a dummy
down
for us.
He's generous.
Yes, that is very true. Yes.
And he helps people.
He is a centurion, so he's of 100 men.
That's very true.
Maybe.
Anybody else? All right.
Wait, yeah.
Okay. Sorry.
Yeah. He prayed continually, so he was described as God-fearing by his servants, which
right.
I think speaks a lot to what kind of leader he was. If they when asked of their leader, they immediately contribute God-fearing to him. I think that speaks a lot about his character.
Yeah.
And how he was God loving a lot. So.
Yeah. We're going to talk about all three of those things. Anybody else?
He was obedient. When he saw a vision, he immediately acted upon it.
He was humble.
Just like you, right, Cornelius?
Yeah.
I was writing down traits that I need to.
he was well-spoken by the whole Jewish nation. And I guess he was Italian.
Yeah.
And later on in the passage, Peter says you know how unlawful it is for a Jew to associate or visit with another nation. So the fact that like the Jews even spoke well of him, even though it was unlawful, I think is very telling as well.
We talked about how he's like Beth said, he's adaptingly obedient. Like first he's obedient to the Old Testament covenant, and then he changes once
yeah.
God.
All right, so this text kind of leads up to what Jeremiah actually talked about 3 weeks ago in the table, and it's verses 34 to 43, and I would recommend for y'all to read that later. But basically, it would be considered like a truth bomb. So this is just leading up to that. A lot of describing what the characters are, a lot of visionary work, stuff like that. But anyway, from transitioning from Acts 9 to Acts 10, Cornelius is definitely more toned down in comparison to Saul, because if you remember, Saul in Acts 9 was breathing threats and murder against the disciples. And he was pretty intense. In Acts 9. So it's definitely a solid change between the two texts. But like Beth said, he was a centurion, which is a commander of about 100 soldiers of the Italian cohort, which is anywhere from 600 to 1,000 soldiers. And he was stationed in Caesarea, which is a city about 30 miles north of Joppa. So if you can kind of think of that, it's like in the middle of Judea. And it's a large port city on the Mediterranean coast. And so that's kind of your background information about where this is taking place. But so I had a couple things. He's prepared. God has made him prepared to receive the gospel that Peter is going to present to him, actually after verse 33, which is where we ended. But you have to think about what is Cornelius thinking. I mean, he's in his hour of prayer and he gets this vision from God. Like, he's probably thinking, like, what the heck is happening? And if he knows that a Jew is going to come to his house, as he being a Gentile, he knows this is a pretty big deal. So he gathers all of his, well, I think it says, close relatives and friends, yeah, and has them at his house when Peter comes. So he is prepared for what is to come later on in the chapter. Also, two other kind of characteristics that go along with being a centurion, which is that he gets paid very well, and he's socially well off and economically well off. And so he was the kind of person, if Cornelius told you to come to his house, you would go. Like, he's that kind of guy. Very well known, and he's well liked by most Jewish people, even though he is a Gentile, just because he's high in authority. So I think this shows some light as to why God chose Cornelius. I mean, if he has so many connections in the area, well, if Peter brings the gospel to his house, then he's going to have 20 people, I don't even know, 20 or 30 people there, and then that automatically multiplies the spreading pretty quickly. And like Travis said, he is a God-fearer. Luke uses this throughout Acts several times, but basically what it is it's someone who's practicing most of the Jewish faith. He's worshiping the God of the Old Testament, observing the Sabbath, keeping the Old Testament ethical code, attending synagogue, all that kind of stuff, but he doesn't submit to the conversion rites of circumcision and stuff like that. So the Jews view him as unclean. And unclean really means unacceptable in before God. And as we know, because of this and the resurrection of Jesus Christ, that is no longer true. Everyone is clean in God's eyes, or acceptable. All right, so, and also Travis said about the, he's a prayer, and he gives alms and gives to the poor. And he's also a worshiper. If you remember, at the end, towards the end of this passage, Peter walks into his house and Cornelius just falls on his knees. He's like, and it says, when Peter entered, Cornelius met him and fell down at his feet in worship. But Peter lifted him up, saying, "Stand up, I am too a man." And this can be contrasted to Herod in chapter 12 in Acts, because Herod actually doesn't glorify God and ends up dying in chapter 12. God kills him. It says, on an appointed day, Herod put on his royal robes, took his seat upon the throne, and delivered an oration to them. And the people were shouting, "The voice of God and not of man." Immediately an angel of the Lord struck him down because he did not give God the glory, and he was eaten by worms and breathed his last. It's kind of grotesque, but anyway. So that's a little bit about Peter. Kind of got off track a little bit. So basically we have four things about Cornelius. He actively sought God. He revered God. He was generous in meeting other people's needs, and he prayed. Those are the things we know about Cornelius. And when I first read this passage, I was thinking along the lines of, it said that his giving and his prayer were before God as like a memorial. I was thinking, okay, so does that make him righteous? Like God only sought out him because he did this stuff? And it ends up that God is really started moving in his life way before this passage. And this, we just kind of catch this in midstream, and we're just kind of entering Cornelius's life right in the middle. That relates to me a lot. When I was a child, I just went to church probably once or twice a month, definitely Christmas, Easter, that kind of thing, and really started to take my faith seriously about 2 years ago. And so I think that this really speaks to me as far as God entering right in the middle. And I feel like God was in my life, 19 years ago when I first started going to church. And, he continues today. So, that leads us to question two. Describe Peter and his personality traits that are revealed in this text.
It's another example of obedience.
I use the word responsive. I think it's pretty compatible to God's request to go meet with Cornelius.
He knows God's law that was stated earlier in Leviticus and
right.
throughout the Bible, but and so much so that he told God that he would never eat that stuff three times. Like, God spoke to him and said, "This is what you're supposed to do." And he's like, "No." And it happened, and says in 16 that it happened three times. And I think that's speaks to how, like, it made no sense to him at all, like, what God was telling him,
right.
to the point where he's like, "Wait, are you sure?"
Yeah. And
so he was well versed, I guess. Prior to.
And it says he was inwardly perplexed about the vision. I mean, he didn't know what was going on. And then he later figures it out. We'll get to that.
I think it's a bit of human nature to be a bit skeptical and have some doubt. Because when I read this and he asked me like three times, like, "Are you sure?" It was more like, "Is this a test?"
Right.
Like, that's how I was reading it.
Yeah.
Like, if I was like, "Okay." And then, like, thunderbolt, you know, whoa. You
yeah.
know? I know that you want to be like, "Are you sure?" You just, you know, make. That's
yeah.
how I see it.
In our group, we talked about how he was willing to take risks.
Yes.
Because I think if I were in this situation where I just come out of a vision and then God's like, "There are three men here. Invite them into your home and then take a journey with them," I'd be like,
"Yeah,
thanks." But he, like, obviously is trusting of God's plan, but also, like, he really has no idea, like, where this is leading him, but he's willing to take the risk.
I feel like you read my sheet. Those are my first two. I have.
I've been thinking around. Reading notes.
I feel like when he was questioning God, it's kind of like, I mean, I do it on my own, is, you know, you read a passage, you think you know how to apply it in your life. And, like, he knew Scripture so well, he thought he knew where to apply it, but obviously he wasn't open to everything that God could have been doing in his life, because he wanted to question three times. You know, are we open to, okay, you know, God has not completed the work or the thing that he's teaching us out of a passage, then are we open to where that can apply in our lives?
All right, so I have, like Bess was talking about, responsive to God's request to go meet Cornelius. I mean, it's a pretty big deal when God comes to you as a Gentile and you say, "Go to a Jewish man's house." I mean, go to a Gentile's house and preach the gospel. I mean, it's very out of the ordinary. Like I said, Peter was inwardly perplexed about where God was going with this. And it's later revealed, obviously. He's brave. He's brave to travel away and preach the gospel to people that his own people consider as unclean, and that's also something that I feel like we all probably have a hard time wrapping our minds around. But it was a very vivid distinction between the Jews and the Gentiles, and he was also, just like Cornelius, he was also prepared. God has prepared Peter to proclaim the good news to Cornelius through the vision and the true meaning of it, which we'll get to in question 3. But he also glorifies God, and that's what I was talking about earlier with him. He is actually a worshiper, just like Cornelius. I mean, he's not a person that needs to be worshipped, because just like Herod took it the wrong way, and I mean, now, you know, he's dead. So. Anyway, but I think that what that really shows is that when he glorified God, he was bringing himself kind of in a way that we can really relate to him. I mean, I think that Peter is someone we can look at and be like, "Wow, I can be just like that guy." And we'll get into that a little bit more. That's all I have about Peter for right now. What is the significance? Question 3, what is the significance of Peter's trance or vision?
Well,
things that was said in our group was that it's the vision significance, like, speaks to the fact that, like, we are all Christians now. And we kind of broke down the wall to just Christianity being for Jews.
Exactly, yeah.
So I think we should be all pretty grateful.
At least they're all, like, it's available to all people seeking after God. You can't, like, we talked about there are no more boundaries between people.
Right.
And I guess we, like, the next question talks about barriers, but there aren't, like, they're no longer those, like, social barriers keeping people from knowing God. It's only, like, what's in your heart that keeps you from knowing God. And I think, too, a lot of that also comes with, like, judgment, too. Like, Peter isn't allowed to judge Cornelius, like, for who he is. Which, I mean, I guess that's probably something that God's been saying all along. But because of Jesus, there's even more reason to not be judging one another.
So, yeah, so Peter is inwardly perplexed, like I said, and he, at first, he views Cornelius as too unclean to go spread the gospel to. And at the beginning, right after his vision, he's thinking, all right, so is this vision really about, you know, reptiles and food laws? And no, it's not. I mean, God is saying that this is the end of the customary, you know, food laws and stuff like that. But he's also saying that all of his creation is clean and acceptable before him. And so a lot of it is the uncleanliness is about what comes out of your body, not what goes in. It's about the internal, not the external. And the Jews had always thought that it was about how do we differentiate ourselves between the Israelites and us, like how are we different? And God did that through the laws of Leviticus. So, a verse I found was Mark 7:15. Nothing outside a man can make him unclean by going into him. Rather, it is what comes out of a man that makes him unclean. So, So how do we view others as unclean in a daily application and not as unclean but unacceptable? Like, how would we say that someone is unacceptable before God? And so what kind of barriers do we put up in our mind that separate us between a specific group or person? So that leads us to question four. Give some examples of barriers that you put up in your mind about a group of people. And so someone who you see it as difficult to share the gospel with.
I gave the example of my best friend. She's Catholic. And knowing that we're so close, like, she's probably the one person who knows everything about me. But yet I still can't tell her something that's everything to me.
Right.
You know, it's... we have a different faith and different way we just worship, and that seems to be difficult when I have a problem. You know, I'm praying for you and she prays for me, but when Jesus says, oh, I pray to so-and-so saint for you, and I'm like, no. But, you know, I understand where she's trying to, but it's just difficult for me to tell her that that's not right. It's just difficult.
I think the biggest barriers that I put up is by, like, people's, like, actions. Like, either how they, act in a group of people, or how they treat other people. Like, if a girl's kind of slutty, sorry,
yeah.
Kind of going to judge you. And so those are, like, very physical things. But in a lot of situations, that's all I know about someone.
For me, I guess it's like past relationships with them makes it harder to share, like to share the gospel with them, because it can be offensive. I've been like kind of burned by that a couple times, so it makes it kind of harder for me to say, like, to try and speak truth in their life, knowing that, like, ultimately I might lose a friendship because of it. Like, I have nothing to lose if I don't know the person that well, and it's like,
right.
You know, but once I do know them, and, like, I do enjoy their company, or I do enjoy spending time with them, I'm not going to try and piss them off, you know, so that can make it harder.
One thing, too, I talked about in my group is that the assumption that, like, they're on the same page as me, like, going to A&M, it's, like, very much, like, Southern Bible Belt, like,
mm-hmm.
everyone kind of, like, lives by the same, like, moral code, which doesn't necessarily mean that they love Jesus, but there's often that, like, assumption that everybody's okay, and so you don't then dig deeper or take the risk or, like, to, like, approach the subject
to
someone.
Right. I think it's probably like what Travis said, is you're scared you're going to lose a friendship or something
mm-hmm.
like that, you know. And so. Alright, well, one that I really struggle with is like people who say that they're Christians and go out and party really hard. Like, that's really hard for me. And so I tend to give up easily on people who do that, and I mean, it's a struggle, and I just find it hard to go to a party and be able to, like, share the gospel with someone who's, or even people who are there, not necessarily someone who's hammered or something like that, but so it's just hard sometimes for me to communicate with those people. But really, what I'm trying to get at is the value of these people should not be what kind of boundaries do we make between them. It should be in their hearts. It should be their internal, not their external. Their cleanliness cannot be evaluated based on them drinking or having a different race or different economic status or on a different, you know, level than one of us. One illustration I thought of was the Berlin Wall. Even though the wall was torn down, there were still huge political issues within Germany. And so even though the whole physical uncleanliness kind of boundary state was wrecked, there were still a lot of issues within Berlin. Just like, even if we tear down the walls in our minds of barriers between me and someone else, there's still uncleanliness within my heart because I thought about them in that way in the first place. And so I mean, this passage is really convicting in that I feel like we all, in some way, set up barriers in our minds, just like Peter did with Cornelius, just like the Jews did with the Gentiles. And so this whole passage is talking about how, you know, the bridge is now linked. The two are together now. And God is saying that his creation is acceptable and is clean and it is made in his image. So I had a couple, like, quick lessons that I feel like we learned from Acts 10. God reaches out to those who want to know him. The gospel is open to all people. There are people everywhere eager to believe. And when we are willing to seek the truth and be obedient to the light, God will reward us richly and eternally. And another thing I wanted to reiterate is God is going to prepare us as the proclaimers and the receivers of the gospel. And that's huge because, like I said, and had this activity planned out, which I hope y'all are still thinking about, but just lost my train of thought. So the bridge is still there. So as we have these boundaries between us and maybe the people we wrote on the sheet, God's saying, I'm there with you every step of the way. You go out, do what you're supposed to do, and spread the gospel, and I'll be right there with you. I will have you prepared just like I had Peter prepared and just like I had Cornelius prepared. And it's so true. Like, humans are the messengers of the gospel, and it's our duty to do that. But also, if we think about it, Jesus, if he hadn't gone from place to place, right at the beginning, crossing different boundaries. I mean, there's tons, religious boundaries, geographical boundaries. And if the people in our lives hadn't been bold, like whoever first initiated you into Christianity, we may not be where we are today. And it's awesome to feel like we could be the people that could change someone else's life. And that's exactly what God's getting at, is right there with you. And so I guess like my final sentence is that salvation is for all nations and all people. And that it's our duty to spread it, even when there's a boundary there. So do y'all have any questions about, I don't even know if it was stupid or not, but the fifth question, optional question. But
So who's going to be praying for this?
So I will call you, message you, something like that, and we'll pray for it together. Or not every day, but you're going to pray for it for a month, and then I'll catch up with you throughout the year to make sure it's going good. Hopefully make some progress, you know, throughout the year. So hopefully you put down someone who's like at UT, not like someone who's at Vanderbilt or something. It'd be kind of hard. So.
Okay, I'll put you down.
Well, that's the thing also. It doesn't have to be a non-believer. I mean, there's a lot of people that I need to pray for who are Christians but are weak in the faith.
Yeah, I mean, that's, yeah, definitely true.
Myself included.
Right. I was trying to get at someone who you have a boundary or a barrier in your head. Like, there's some separation between us that's holding us back from what we could really be achieving. And that's a Christ-like relationship. So. And y'all can just put those in this chair or in that red chair at the end. But.